Welcome to today's Chew on This panel, Feeding the Future, How Do We Attract the Next Generation of Food Professionals? The food industry is the largest manufacturing sector in the UK and a cornerstone of the economy, employing millions. Yet at the same time, it's facing a critical workforce challenge, a growing gap between the number of skilled jobs available and the number of people qualified to fill them. In a worrying recent development, the University of Nottingham has announced the suspension of its long-running food science and agriculture undergraduate courses, with no new students being recruited for the 2026-27 cycle as enrolments continue to fall. This has sparked concern across the sector, with many industry voices noting that losing such programmes weakens the talent pipeline for food science, technology and agriculture, just when expertise is urgently needed. This echoes a broader labour market picture in the UK. Many technical roles in food production, quality assurance, engineering and R&D remain hard to fill, reflecting both a lack of awareness of career opportunities and a mismatch between industry needs and education pipelines. Historically, sector reports have highlighted that access to skills and the ability to recruit appropriately qualified people across the food supply chain is a growing problem, one that risks undermining long-term productivity and innovation. Today, we're going to explore not just why the sector is struggling to attract and retain technical talent, but how we can make careers in food science, technology, manufacturing and quality a compelling choice for tomorrow's workforce. So to begin, our panel introduce themselves, starting with Steve.
Yep. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Beadle. I'm the head of talent and development for Oscar Mayer. And my remit sit with recruitment, learning and development and early careers as well.
Hi, I'm Nick Benison. I'm executive director for technical. I look after technical across the whole business. I've been with the business over 18 months.
Hi, I'm Angel Yamuliani, or Angel. So I am the group senior technical services technologist. So I've just moved to group last year, September. And I've been working in the Oscar Mayer for almost 3 years now.
And I'm Robin. I'm the education and careers manager at the Institute of Food Science and Technology, or IFST.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So we've got a very qualified panel, I think, today to talk about this subject. We'll start the session with a little bit about personal journeys. So not everybody plans to have a career in food. I'm guilty of that. I never planned to work in food manufacturing or technical. I simply fell into it. So when did food become your career? And was it a deliberate choice or something that you fell into?
I didn't fall into food. Definitely not. I kind of fell into learning and development, which was probably more of a wider circle with what I sit with now. Food's always been a passion. Food was always there in the background. I trained as a chef when I left school, went to college, worked in hotels, worked for Mackey's, as everybody does when they leave school in the 90s, if anyone was there. So, and I think kind of slipped out of that and then fell into learning and development quite accidentally, and then fell into food manufacturing. It wasn't really by choice, more by desperation after being made redundant during COVID, and then trying to find another job to get me back in. So that's where I found myself. But food has always been in the background of my life. It's an important part of what I do and important part of my life, I think, personally.
And I'll be honest, I've been in the industry for just over 30 years now. And I still don't know what I want to do as a career. I'm still thinking, I'm a technical director now. It was never in the plan to be a technical director. I never had that plan where I want to be there in how many years. I'd always done food catering jobs. So from the age of 14, worked as in food catering, so food has always been there in the days that you could work at 14. And then I did work for a boys' high school as a lab tech, so it was always sciencey based. I always loved the sciences, but really didn't do food at school or anything like that. And then I got a job at a company in Nottingham as a taste panel person, and that was it. From there onwards, I just kept going. So I worked my way up from being a taste panel technician through to where I am today. And it's, like I say, it's been an amazing career. I've done so many things across those 30 years. And I just love what I do. And actually, whilst I didn't want to get here, that wasn't the plan. I wanted to be, I think it was a doctor or a teacher. I've loved it all the way along, highs and the lows.
For me, because this is my first official food job, either in the UK or in Indonesia, I'm just trying to align with my background, which is in food technology. I have a bachelor in food technology. And then I thought to myself, like, I was working as a teacher at that time. I was a science teacher for 2 years. I thought, I'll try to become, like, you know, working as a food scientist or food technologist at that time. So I applied as a food science and nutrition student for a master's degree in Sheffield. But then I applied with a placement year. And I thought that here, placement is like given to you. But then I didn't know that you need to apply for like a real job. So it's very hard, especially as an international student and a master student too. Yeah, it's very hard for me to find placement year. But here I am. And I enjoy it very much.
I'm Robin.
Yes, I guess for me, I used to be really interested in cooking as when I was growing up. I used to cook at home with my dad every weekend and spend all my time deciding what to cook. Made me do an NVQ in catering on Saturdays, and I always wanted to become a chef. I competed in some young chef competitions and won the regional Young Chef of the Year competition, which was sponsored by Samworth Brothers. And I got to go around their factory near Leicester, which made pork pies. And someone at Samworth Brothers at the time said, you can either go into catering, but it's quite stressful and unsociable hours, or you can have a really rewarding career in the food industry or food manufacturing. So I did the A-level, which was available in food technology at the time, and went to study food science at the University of Nottingham and did a placement year at PepsiCo and then a research master's for McCain Foods. After graduating, I worked for Channel 4 on a programme called Food Unwrapped, which is a programme to dispel myths about the food sector and the food industry. I was really interested in communication, and then a role came up at IFST, really passionate about communication and the sector.
Brilliant. I think it's quite clear actually from that all of you, even though your roots into food would be different, you've all got that passion and underlying love of food and that at the core of your journeys, which is nice to hear. I think it's always important to be a foodie in food, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So if we think about why food isn't a career choice, or food isn't a career of choice for people, I think looking back at my time at school, I was told, and I know other people that I know were told, if you don't do well in your school exams, you're going to end up in a factory, working in a factory. It's demonised a little bit. It's almost like to scare you into trying doing really well at school. But we know that factories can be the most rewarding places for a career. What do you think young people imagine when they hear food manufacturing? Is it negative?
Personally, I think, yeah, I think there's, when you think about food factories, depending on where you are, you could either be in a really hot factory if you're in a bakery, or you could be in a really cold factory because you're in a chilled factory. There isn't really like a sort of in the middle mainly in terms of, you know, my area of where I've worked. So I think people struggle because they don't understand how many careers there are available, because yes, we're talking about food and technical and things like that, but actually there's that a lot of careers like L&D. But I think it's not exciting. It's not sexy, is it? It's like you make food, but actually it's a key part of life that we need that, and we're always going to need that. So I think that's part of the issue, is it's not, like you say, it's been demonized. I've got an example of that with my son, who was told that he'd end up working in McDonald's for the rest of his career. No offense to McDonald's, they have a really good management program, excellent management program, and they do really well, but he was threatened with that by one of his English teachers. So it's like, I get what you're saying. So I think the demonizing in school of things like that, the fact that people see it as boring, don't know what we're doing and not exciting, doesn't help us.
It's also the perception that is given as well, because, you know, if you look at TV, if you look at social media, we can see inside the factory, we can see Food Unwrapped, as Robin mentioned, which is another one that's on TV. You never see inside the technical lab. You never see, you know, learning and development of food manufacturing companies. You never see it's almost seen as not interesting. People want to see the grit, they want to see the lines, they want to see millions of products being pulled through lines all the time, they want to see how things work. But when all you show people is the factory side of the business, that's just a very, very small part of how our business works. That's the product side. They don't see everything else. Let's show a TV program that says, what does an NPD development chef do? How does a product go from an idea to a line? We're missing out a fundamental part of our process, and we're just selling the end bit. We're not selling everything else that goes in between.
I think Hotel Chocolat did a couple of kind of inside the factory, but their own type of program on that. And they quite nicely took people through the pipeline and development of some of their products, which was quite good to see that part. But I don't think I've seen much else on the telly where you go through that whole process of concept to launch effectively. Yeah.
And I think it's the same as like in Indonesia, because like when I'm at school, my teacher also tell me like, oh, if you don't do well, then you'll end up in the factory. It's interesting how like different, we're in different continents and it's still the same thing, right? But then I think like when I'm talking to my friends, oh, I work in the food industry, all they ask is that, how's your salary?
Yeah.
So I think it's just like long hours if we're working in a factory 12 hours. But then it's also like I have a respect to those who's working like 12 hours because during my placement year, I was placed on the line and oh, it's very hard for me.
It's a hard job.
Them, yeah, it's a really very hard job.
I think as well, it's funny, there's a kind of a disconnect between people think obviously chefs make food, but then they don't realise that the food that you can buy in a supermarket obviously isn't made by chefs, it's made by manufacturers. And even the ingredients that chefs use are often made by manufacturers. There's a weird disconnect in young people not really knowing that people make the food that you buy in the supermarkets.
And that's important to think about as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the whole, I think there's not just that disconnect in food manufacturers making the food, but it's the disconnect in where have the ingredients come from as well, isn't it, in kind of primary agriculture. And there's a big disconnect there.
There's a map. If you map the job to make a product, it's huge, isn't it? It's not just us as a food manufacturer in a factory. You've got all your suppliers, you've got all the farmers, you've got all the transport that goes with it, you've got the transport at the other end, you've got storage, distribution. So it's huge. And if you drew that map out, it'll fill a number of A3 pieces of paper, I think. So.
I think as well on the packaging side of stuff, it's not just a tray, it's then the sleeve, but think about the inks that have gone on the sleeves as well. So there's jobs everywhere, aren't there, that relate either directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
I think it's just about breaking down the framing of it. It's the way we frame the food industry in general. It's not broken down well enough. There's very few pictures of science, of data, of problem solving, of leadership, of all of those parts that go into that, you know, and particularly when it comes into things like innovation and stuff and sustainability as well. I mean, I think there's so many things out there that don't break it down far enough because they believe people are only interested in the product. It's that end product that people want to see. What do you do? What do you make? What's the end goal without the work going into it? And that goes back a long, long way. I know we're going to talk about kind of where that goes, but it goes back quite a long way.
So thinking, staying along with schools, education, early engagement, what point do you think we need to be engaging with students in education? When they're at university, they already know what they want to study and they might have a vague idea of what they want to do when they graduate. They might not, but they've picked a course that aligns maybe with some career opportunities. That almost for me feels a bit too late. You don't want to be pitching at that point. I think it needs to be earlier, but how early? Because by A levels, you've already made the choices that will get you kind of to uni. Is it GCSE? Is it earlier?
It's quite interesting because like if I look at my children going through school and then on to further education. At nursery, they were doing cooking and stuff like that. You know, they learn about that. Then they do a little bit in the little schools. And as they get older, I think personally, before GCSE, when people are choosing their GCSEs, we should be doing more before then because you can do food technology. My daughter did food technology GCSE and some of it was good and some of it wasn't good. It was interesting to see what she was doing. A lot of cooking, but again, not necessarily all technology. So I think one, we'll probably talk about that later, is around what those courses look like. But I think we should get in before GCSEs. I think we need to go in earlier because we want people to be taking those courses if they're available to then think about what they want to do future.
Mm. Yeah, no, agreed. It's not early enough. And we need to balance up what people want to do as a career with what people are passionate about.
Yeah.
As Robin said, it made a really, really good point. You know, it wasn't necessarily it's not about the career. It's about just the having that passion in food. Food manufacturing and the food industry, it's not an appealing industry to work in. It just isn't. You have to find people who are passionate about food.
Yeah.
And then drawing on that passion to do that. It does go back a long way. And I know we've had various conversations about where this kind of picks up. We're going into schools year 8. We're doing a careers kind of thing this year before they take their options. But it's whether or not the options are there, you know. And we kind of say that if food isn't visible at the early age, then it's never going to be chosen when they have to choose it, when that choice comes around. If it's not visible earlier, so I'm talking even to the point of primary school, if it's not there, which invariably isn't, it's never going to be chosen because no one's ever going to want to do that. When the Department of Education removed home economics in 2015 from schools, there's no surprise as to why we have a lack of chefs and food professionals 10 years later because the people that would have been choosing them now can't.
Yeah.
You know, everything's gone down. And when I say kind of home economics, I know people are not, you know, that was what we used to do. Yeah. Bring in a pot, make some jam tarts, take them home to your mum, you know, all that kind of stuff. This is what we did. That's what got me going. They were the lessons that I used to look forward to in school, but they're now gone. Everything's so primarily focused. And it's interesting what you said about Nottingham Uni, about them dropping courses because they're not getting the enrolment levels now, or because there's nothing to lead them into it.
Yeah.
From what I know, from what I see, there isn't anything that leads students to that way.
Yeah. Do you see that as well, Robin, in the work that you do?
As soon as the A-level dropped, that's when the university started experiencing these recruitment problems. And as I mentioned at the beginning, say a big high-profile course, the University of Nottingham, has ceased to exist from this year. So the universities are really struggling to recruit interested people onto the courses.
I think it's sad to hear that. I mean, I studied at Harper, which is an agriculture and food university. So everybody that went to Harper had a shared kind of love or passion either for agriculture, countryside, farming, food. It was a small uni, 2,500-3,000 students, but everybody there, like, it just felt like the vein that ran through the school was food and farming.
Yeah.
So it's sad to hear that we're losing courses that offer that.
Yeah, I did my first degree through Brackenhurst College, which then became Nottingham Trent University while I was there. But mine was the old style day release, sort of like old style apprenticeship where you went for a day release. But again, everyone was there for a reason because everyone was in industry. There was full-time students, but there wasn't many. And then the rest of us were part-time students that were in industry and we were there to do that, which I think, you know, worked really well. It was good and you wanted to be there and you were learning.
Yeah.
And I think what we've mentioned just now about, like, for example, like a piece of banana, if we map it, it's a lot, right? And I think getting that exposure to children so that they know, oh, for a piece of banana, like, you have the logistic, you have the R&D if you want to make a cake. But then, I mean, like, getting that exposure because, like, I think when people talk about food or food industry, they will only think about QA, mm-hmm. R&D. What else? Operations.
Yeah. Supermarkets.
When I applied for technical, I don't know what I'm doing. Because, like, in Indonesia, there's no technical role. It's separate. Like, we have regulatory, you have QA, QC, blah, blah, blah. But then when I applied for technical, I was like, okay, I'll learn on the job. But now I know that it's a combination of everything. And yeah, I think, like, getting exposure as early as possible is key. And also, like, from my experience, when I did my bachelor degree in food technology, most of my friends at that time think, like, food technology is just cooking. It's also different. I thought it's also like cooking and a bit of biology, but then there's a lot of chemistry. And I felt like, oh, maybe I chose the wrong major because, like, in Indonesia, we don't have, like, GCSEs, we don't have A-levels. We have, when we're in high school, it's just separated into, like, science or socials, and that's it. And you just study, like, either biology, chemistry, and that's it. Here in the UK, people are fortunate enough to, like, have subject specific so that when they go into college or university, they roughly know what they're learning about because they've did the GCSE, they've did the A-levels and stuff.
Do you know what? I think that's a really important point. And I'd be keen to hear what Robin has to say about this one, actually, because I think it's interesting. Robin, based on what you've said, with regards to the numbers of kind of people coming through dropping, do you think there's kind of connection with the university entrance requirements, particularly in things like food-based science courses that favour biology and chemistry and things like that rather than something different? Do you think the requirement is playing a factor in that of what people need to get in order to get on those courses?
We have a group called At UK Food Science, and it's a group of universities, industry. This is a big committee of people that kind of represent food science courses in the UK, and they are looking at their entry requirements at the moment, I guess, due to that they don't want to put any barriers in terms of people wanting to study in the field.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking when we're saying about how far back should we go, if you think there is there was a lot of noise a while ago about children not knowing where food came from. So young children, so they just assume carrots are grown in a supermarket. They're in a supermarket, wasn't it? Because we've lost even the basic stuff. Like, actually, it comes from a farm and it's grown in a field and it is dirty and we have to do stuff to it. So there was a big thing, I remember that, and it was in the press a while ago about children not understanding, and there was programmes on TV about it, that children are not understanding where food comes from.
There was a concept as well, FaceTime a Farmer, that was quite big. So started by a guy called Farmer Tom. Probably after 2016, he set up this concept, FaceTime a Farmer, so school classrooms could set up a FaceTime call with a dairy farm to see where milk comes from. Maybe there's more that we could be doing with that as an industry.
Yeah.
I think it goes both ways as well, because I think we attended an event last year about agriculture, which was about apprenticeships in the food industry and nutrition and things like that, which was a lot of suppliers. It was a lot of food suppliers that came to that, farmers and things like that. And the farmers couldn't really tell us what happened to their product once it left them. It's that disconnect between the two. They could tell us how to grow it, how to harvest it, and how to get it to a certain point. But once it left them, we're like, well, so do you know what happens to your food once it goes? And they're like, no.
You put it in a pot.
That's it. We don't know. We don't know what really happens to it. Yeah. And it was that gap in the middle, in the fact that we can bring the suppliers and the growers into the conversation, but they've really got to know where their products are going and what they're going into, as much as we need to know where our products are coming from. So it's that meat in the middle kind of thing.
Yeah. So what role should we play as an industry in schools? I know, Robin, you launch the IFST, have the student launchpad events, which targeted at people already at university, maybe looking at careers in food. And I know there'll be placement fairs and stuff, or careers fairs, careers advice at uni. Mm. But what else can we be doing as an industry to support?
As the UK's leading professional body for food science and technology, IFST plays a vital role in allowing people to spread the word about careers in the food sector. So we've recently made something called the Food Industry Outreach Toolkit. And basically the purpose of the toolkit is to support you to raise awareness about the food industry. And it's a set of accessible, customizable resources for you to go out and deliver in your local community. So it's available at www.lovefoodlovescience.org. And if you click on Outreach Toolkit, and basically what we've done is create a series of slide packs, which are editable, so you can kind of drag and drop your images, your information about your career. The slides contain statistics about the food industry, engaging videos, factory tours, printable activity sheets for you to deliver in schools, basically to facilitate your outreach, because we feel that people need to go into schools because they're not having the A level. We need to increase exposure in schools. So you can use this outreach toolkit to do that.
And I mean, we are members of the Chilled Foods Association, so the CFA, and they, advocate for STEM ambassadors. They do a lot of work around getting people into schools. They have the micro trumps, which is the playing cards with all the microbiological bacteria on, which are very exciting. And, as a business, we're looking at that, aren't we? We've asked all our team who wants to be a STEM ambassador. And again, they have information and documents that we can use to then go into schools once you've done your checks to go into schools. Obviously you need to be able to do that first and make sure it's all okay, but again, that's another way of doing it. But that's down for us as an industry, an individual business doing that, but doing it through with the help of either IFST or CFA. So there are definitely resources out there that we can tap into as an industry.
I
was gonna say, so as part of the toolkit, we've got a series of information on how to become a STEM ambassador, and we would really recommend using the scheme to do any outreach, because it gives you a free DBS check and has a fantastic platform to be able to search for opportunities. So if you're a teacher, you can post your event that you want someone to speak at on the STEM ambassador platform. So as a STEM ambassador, you can go onto the platform, view a handy little map of which teachers are wanting outreach in your area, and you can kind of book yourself onto, maybe it's a science day, maybe they're looking for someone to be a speaker in an after-school chemistry class to go and deliver outreach. So that's fantastic. You can also set yourself up as an offer. So if I'm Robin, I'm happy to deliver a welcome to food science activity within the 30-mile radius of my house. I can set myself up as an offer on that platform, and people can book you teachers can see you, happy to do that and can book you whenever they like. So it's a really powerful platform. And we've got on the IFSC Outreach Toolkit, we've got a guidance on how to become a STEM ambassador. So I'd really recommend checking that out. The other thing in terms of rolling it out in industry, so if you become a STEM ambassador, you'll soon be able to join the Food and Drink Ambassador Scheme, which is a scheme that we've set up through STEM. And this allows us to see, as an institute, how many hours of outreach are being delivered across the UK using the Outreach Toolkit and that are involved in food and drink. And a really fantastic part of STEM is that, say, Oscar Mayer can set themselves up as a scheme as well. And Oscar Mayer can view how many of their employees are delivering outreach. It's just a data sharing agreement with STEM. So I'd really recommend employers can see how many hours of outreach their employees are delivering.
Steve, I think you were going to make a point earlier.
I was just going to make a the entry point to it all about, you know, it's, I think the question was, you know, what role can we play? I think from a food industry specifically point of view, you know, we need to stop being occasional visitors and start being long-term partners in the education side of things. And it's not just in the, you know, it's not just in the science side and the technical side, it's in all of the sides. You know, we have mass shortages of so many different areas in the food industry because food is not being, it's probably being discussed, but probably not in the way that we'd like it to be discussed from an industry to make people go, I want to be part of that. You know, I want to use what I'm learning at school now to turn that to food or the journey of food. So I think it's the partnership side of it that we need to start looking at as a, not just as a company, but as an industry.
And I think there's the competitiveness of us as a food industry. If you look now, how many Amazon Every warehouses, which are nice, warm warehouses, you know, and they do a lot more. You see a lot now on TV advertisement, don't you, about what Amazon are doing about training and education for their people. We are competing against those to get people into place and into roles or into the industry. So it's, as an industry, you don't really see anything much on TV anymore about apprenticeships in the food industry. You don't see any social media really targeting that, whereas, you know, Amazon's all over the TV talking about what they're doing. So I think maybe that's something as an industry we need to take away and think about how we do better on that and get something there.
100%. Looking outside of what we can do, what could be done by, I don't know, the government, by schools, by, I don't know.
Well, I think, Robin, maybe we need to put the A-level back in, so that will help us if they've got a path. Because, like you say, there's no pathway at the moment. You do a GCSE and then you've got nowhere to go other than science. Maybe that's a starter for one.
I think there is a bit of a gap in the level 3 qualification between GCSE and if you're leaving school. There are conversations I'm aware of that are to try and bring it back, but I think it's a long way off. A lot of schools have taken out a lot of their kitchens and things, and to bring back the A-level, I think, is quite a long way off. So the IFST are involved in a project at the moment looking at something called the WJEC Level 3 qualification. Whilst there isn't an A-level in England, there is an A-level in Northern Ireland, in food, there is in Scotland, there is in Wales. In Wales, they're delivering a diploma, which is kind of equivalent to an A-level, and there's nothing to stop English schools teaching that qualification. And there are a lot of English schools delivering that Level 3 qualification, which has just been relaunched. So IFST are involved in a project at the moment to try to back that launch and get more schools to deliver that Level 3 qualification in England. Because at the moment, as I mentioned before, there's 60,000 young people doing the GCSE really interested in food, and they haven't really got a step to then get onto these food courses at the end of school. So we're really trying to throw a weight behind this Level 3 qualification to get more schools to deliver it, because at the moment there isn't anywhere for them to go. They can go and study science at A level to get on to food science degrees, but a lot of them want to continue doing that food qualifications.
Brilliant. It's good to know that there's somebody in industry at least trying to help fight the corner, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, and then if we think less than about the attraction of people, so say we have attracted people into industry, how do we retain them? because staff turnover is a huge thing in food. Probably got higher levels of staff turnover in the food industry as a whole than we do across other industries. So once we've got the good people, what do we do to keep them?
it's a tough one. We talk about predominantly, I can only talk about food manufacturing because that's where we look, not necessarily the whole food industry, but from a manufacturing point of view, you know, in many organizations, and we talk to a lot of our competitors, so, you know, we're all in kind of groups where we get to talk to each of the companies that essentially work side by side with us in that. But one of the things out there is that, you know, progression exists, but it's not visible. It's just not visible. And it's not actively discussed. We don't really discuss it as much because it's too difficult to create it in the process as it is. You know, the manufacturing is a very head down kind of industry in the fact that, you know, it's all about product. We've got volumes, we've got products, we've got deadlines, we've got all of those parts to hit. Everything sits with those deadlines within that. So pushing a development culture through food manufacturing is incredibly difficult. And trust me, I've been trying to do it for the last 4 years. And we are getting there. We are making massive headway with that. But I think people start to disengage when they don't see what the future is. And I think that's part of it. If people can't see where they're going, then they will look to go somewhere else. And I think that's the biggest part of that. Yeah. And it's creating those, where we talk about those career journeys. And, you know, if I come in as a food technologist, for example, what are my options? Where do my options go from there? You know, what's my timeline? What am I expected to do? You know, I dare say there's people in this room now that have worked for one or more of our competitor companies. We move around into these companies, right? So if the opportunities aren't here, they're going to be with someone else, regardless. So,
yeah, and I think as you go up the ladder, there are less roles, mm-hmm. because that's the, you know, it's how it works, yeah. When you move forward. And I think what we have to do as an industry and as a business is do our best to keep and retain our people, keep them interested in the role. Last year, we launched with the technical team our technical capability framework, mm-hmm. that maps from being a QA through to my role as a technical director and all the bits that you need to do in between. And it isn't just talking about let's do lots of qualifications or apprenticeships. It's talking about experience. It's talking about exposure. And what we want people to be able to do is, you know, map that over the next 3 to 5 years. What does that development plan look like, which we're working on? Everyone's done their gap analysis at the moment. And then actually, how do we then support that? Because it's an individual's responsibility for their own development, but we're here to support them and move and get them what they need. So that's been a really positive thing, I feel, for us as a business. And I'm an advocate for that. The people piece is a really key part for me in that development. And the succession planning is the next step as well. We're already talking about who wants what roles. And I think the first question I asked when I joined the business and then as people join is, where do you want to be? That has to be the first question you ask an individual, is where do you want to be? Because when you know where they want to be, you can go, right, okay, then how do we map that and how do we get you there? And unfortunately, it may not be within this business because we don't have a role, but we're giving you the best opportunity and we're trying to keep you as long as we can. But you're then in the right place when you are ready to move on and upwards. So for me, that technical framework is a real key thing because it gives some structure to the process. It gives people an actual clear plan and then we can develop around that.
I think as well, the nice thing with the technical capability framework is it takes some of the, I guess, the barriers out for the managers as well, because it helps to encourage the conversation about development with their direct reports. And it gives them a little bit more of a framework and a guidance piece. If it's not something, say, for example, you've worked in process all of your life and you've got somebody in your team that then wants to go on and do something, for example, in hygiene, that piece is there so you can know how to best develop and how to help your team move into those roles.
And it might be a sideward move because you want to move department, and eventually we'll have it for all functions. The team are working on that for all functions, and you might want to become an operational person, which means we still keep you in the business but you change function. Not ideal for technical. We don't want to lose our good people.
Good if they take the best bits of technical operations,
yeah. Which is good. I think that's it's a key thing to do, and you know, it's definitely Oscar Mayer. We are definitely working on that.
And then, like, 3 years I've been here, there's a lot of change. I mean, like, my role is new, and then I know that the group roles in technical is new. So I think it's just like, maybe when I join, it's like the maximum is just the technical service manager, and then after that you become a technical manager. But then suddenly there's like a group technical service manager, which like, oh, what is that? And then suddenly there's like a group technical services. And so I think like, what is it, in time, there will be a lot of change, especially like industry, food manufacturing, or any other manufacturing. There's a lot of changes. I feel like as long as the company can invest in the talent, people will stay.
Yeah. Robin, have you got any thoughts to add on that?
I guess, yeah, in terms of retaining people in industry, I guess from our side, we'd really recommend you being part of a professional body like IFST, because it can really kind of increase satisfaction. You meet people working across industry. You can join special interest groups with other like-minded people that are interested in certain fields, attend events, attend factory visits and things. So, yeah, I guess in terms of retaining people in industry, being part of a professional body like IFST would be a great thing.
Yeah.
And we are members, as Oscar may. We're just about to sign up for our second year of cohort. So.
And that's been, it's given people the opportunity to join webinars or have access to other materials that they might not have had access to. So what's at risk if we don't fix our skills gap?
As you mentioned earlier, the universities are really struggling to recruit for interested people onto their courses. If that continues to happen, we might see more closures of courses, which will then provide a big knock-on effect to companies looking for new talent and recruiting for roles in the sector.
The risk with the skills is you can't have one without the other. You know, food security is impossible without skills security. You know, it simply would not function. You know, we can invest in anything we want. We can invest in factories, machinery, technology. But without the technical expertise that sits within the business, none of it will work. It's impossible for it to work. But with that, you know, we also have to remember that skills like that, they take time to build. You can't replace experience overnight, which obviously flips back into the retention side of things. Losing technical knowledge is a massive risk to a business, to any business. It's a huge, huge risk to the business, and one that we can't really afford to have. We have to have it all the time. So we have to be able to kind of invest, and we have to in development and skills development and making sure those gaps aren't there. And when we fill those gaps, how do we keep those gaps filled and not lose something to someone else? Or if a piece of technology comes out, it does act. Sometimes technology can create a gap. It doesn't always fill a gap, but it can create one as well. So how do we fill that as we go along? It's about being super reactive to the industry and what's happening as well.
And I think my concern as a business, as an industry, we can fall over quite easily. You know, we already see the amount of alerts and recalls of, you know, and that's not saying that's because there's a technical gap, but the more technical gaps we get and the less trained technical or expertise we have, the less good decision making could potentially happen, and we become weaker in our food safety and our food defence, and that worries me.
Yeah. I think as well, from a culture perspective, food safety doesn't just sit with technical, does it? It sits with everybody. Yeah. So it isn't just a lack of skilled technical people that we're going to see. It'll be maybe a lack of skilled operational people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Which is where sometimes we can have a gap.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Just need to encourage people. Wish it was that easy. What skills do you think are the hardest to replace?
I have a view on this, and it may be right or wrong, but it's my view. I think there's been a lot around technical knowledge and experience. I think as technical managers and then technical leaders as they go up the business, it's also having a balance around the people piece. I think we have had a lot of good people that are technically sound, but then don't have the people management skills. We're all talking about retaining people and developing them and investing in them. If we don't have a rounded leadership team and people coming through and playing and using those skills as well, I think that becomes a problem. So whilst we're losing technical expertise, I think we've already sometimes got a gap. We actually already do have a gap in that leadership piece around people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'd say the same thing, you know. From a technical point of view, you know, you're looking at like that deep technical judgment piece that sits in there. So, you know, people who can combine science with regulation, with risk, with commercial reality, and put all of that together into one kind of place. But we also have to remember that a lot of the experience that we have, and when I talk experience, I'm talking years gained experience, that generation is now approaching retirement. And this isn't ethnic cheers. And that's not just in technical either. You know, that's operationally. Yeah. I mean, there is a huge, huge skills gap in engineering.
Yeah.
Not just in food. This is right across the board. And again, because this is the price of progression, knowledge transfer isn't happening fast enough when it can't keep up with the pace. So knowledge transfer hasn't moved quickly enough, which is why we now see a huge gap in mechanically minded engineers against electrically minded engineers, because everyone wants automation, everyone wants advanced manufacturing, and we are nowhere near advanced manufacturing. You know, we are still a manual food manufacturing company. I have conversations with, we sat on a panel recently with Wrexham Uni and College Cambria, who were talking about advanced manufacturing, and said to them, look, that just isn't going to work for me now. In 5 years' time, maybe, but now, our skills gap is now.
Yeah.
What are you doing now for what we have? And so I think that all of those things, they just take time, they take exposure, they take mentoring, they take all of those things to work and to come together.
And a lot of the decisions you make as you go through your career is based on probably the battle scars you've had from previous, where something has gone wrong and you've maybe made the wrong decision and you go, oh, well, something's gone wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because if you're new into the industry, it's hard to have that, because unless you live through an experience like that, you can understand it, but you don't necessarily learn from it.
Yeah.
You can be told what happened, but if you haven't gone through it. And hopefully we would like to have less issues that we have to then next put people through. But I think that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's also then having the resilience yourself. If you're going through a bad audit, a lot of us have been there in the past where we've had a particularly difficult or a challenging audit or something, but it's having the resilience then to pick yourself up after and think, well, it's not every day, is it? What can I learn from it? And how can it make me better moving forwards?
I think we've talked about like the technical skills, but from my perspective, the skills to be willing to learn, to always improve yourself, to be proactive, it's very important if you want to survive in the food industry, in any industry, because like without being proactive, like what can you do? I mean, like you've only sit there to be asked what to do, and then that's it. And also, if we're talking about skills, there's one thing that I'm actually quite curious about the industry in the UK. Like, okay, there's a lot of skills shortage, but then there's a lot of international students studying, and we're given a graduate visa that is valid for 2 years. But then I think now they shorten it because not a lot of graduates can have a job. So I am actually very fortunate to secure a job for 2 years. But I just want to know, what's the reason? I mean, like, is 2 years too short, or... Because, like, the students, like my friends that is studying in a master's degree as the same course as me, they have, like, a lot of experience. They've worked in Unilever or technical for 5 years or more, but then they cannot even secure a job and they have to leave the country.
So we've just there's been time invested in that individual being here and, you know, allowing you to be here to study, but then we're not as a country not allowing you to be on 2 years or 18 months or however long it is now to stay and actually use that knowledge that you've learned here to use, which is, it does seem a little bit backwards.
Yeah. 100%. Robin, have you got any thoughts on that?
I guess, I can't really comment on the length of the visas post study, but I do know it's there are a lot of people, international students studying in the UK, particularly on master's courses, and there is this problem with them not being able to continue working in the UK afterwards, which I guess is a government decision, but there are a lot of interested people, as you say, studying and not able to work afterwards, and partly due to companies not being able to sponsor visas post study. But I don't know if I can really comment on that anymore.
You know, I wouldn't comment on it either, Robin. And sponsorship comes up a lot. It's one of those questions. But the restrictions and limitations around sponsorship, it's not easy enough. It's a really complicated subject, and certainly not one for this discussion. But it is complicated. If it were easier, if it was made an easier process, then I think we would see more people doing it. I think it would be easier to keep that talent for as long as we possibly can. But it's not always the easiest process in the world.
No. Okay. I think what we'll do now is we'll move on to a couple of rapid fire questions before we finish. And then we're going to finish off with one last question, and then we'll hand over to the audience. Steve, we'll start with you.
Of course.
Most urgent skill gap right now, quality, technical, engineering, or data?
Engineering.
Nick, is the challenge more about awareness, image, or opportunity?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Probably the first two.
Awareness and image. Robin, one for you. Do you think closing courses like food science sends the right message to young people?
No.
Angel, which matters more for recruitment, salary, progression, or purpose?
Salary progression.
Steve, is Brexit still making the skills gap harder to fill?
No.
Okay. And this is for all of you. You can all answer this one. Which is the better route? Is it more apprenticeships, more graduate scheme, or better career marketing?
Better career marketing.
Yeah, better career marketing.
All of them. And Robin?
I'd say, yeah, all of them, or yeah, better career marketing.
Brilliant. Okay. So to finish off, what needs to change? What do we need to do differently to attract people?
I think we need to get out there and sell ourselves more. Personally, I think we need to be showing all the really good sides of all the stuff that we do. And, you know, through the IFST, through CFA, all the other agencies and places we do it. And we need to do it as a whole. This isn't about being competitive with our competitors. It's about us being as an industry. And I think we just need to be out there and be more vocal. And you know what? It'd be great to get something on telly, on TV at prime time, wouldn't it? To say, yeah, come and go work in the food industry. I think the government could probably help us a little bit with that as well, because... Yeah. You know, they need to put it into their food strategy plan and the fact that we're going to have food around. So
we need to get people. Banned the advertisement of HFSS foods on television at certain times. They could replace that with
come and work in the food industry. I mean, what you could do. So I think promotion of what we need, you know, is definitely a key thing we can do.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thing. I said we desperately need to stop underselling ourselves as an industry to work in. And I think we do that. And I think, you know, we need to stop talking about food manufacturing as a backup.
Yeah.
You know, it needs to be a career choice.
A plan A.
I think 100%, yeah. And I think we definitely need to look at, from scratch, from that point of view, you know, we need to design the clear entry routes, the visible progression, the stronger links between education and industry need to happen. You know, we need to start making those ties and putting them together. And from a business point of view, you know, we need to treat kind of technical talent as a strategic asset and not just a compliance necessity, I think is part of that.
I want to give you an applause for that answer. I really like that.
Yeah. I feel like we need to have a clear, visible pathway from graduate to leadership. This is talking about like the students that have already learned in university, but then they don't know where to go. Because like we discussed just now, like there's a lot of roles in the food industry, but then people are just knowing about NPD, operations, but then there's a lot more, right? So early exposure to different job titles and proper onboarding and when they're coming in so that they know like, oh, for example, if they're a QA, how can they progress like the technical framework? That's why I want to introduce to you. So IFST just created a new committee. It's called the Students and Early Career Committee, which aims to actively bridge the gap between the students and the early careers that they, for example, they don't know where they're going. They don't know that there's a lot of factories, like apart from ready meals or any other factories. So basically just creating spaces where experienced professionals, industries, they can learn from each other, and students can also learn with that.
And that's a committee that you've been selected to chair?
Yes. Yeah. So yesterday, me and Robin just meet each other for the first time, and we talk about the aim of the committee and where we're going from that.
Yeah.
Robin, if you want to add something about the committee.
No, it's fantastic to have you on board and, really excited to see how that committee develops.
Brilliant. And Robin, what do you think needs to change?
Yeah, I think the food industry is full of exciting and fruitful careers. There's lots of opportunities to learn, grow, travel, and make a positive impact. We want to increase awareness of this industry to young people. And for such a large industry, it's really operating under the radar at the moment. And it's an everyone's problem in terms of getting it out there. So I would really say that this new food industry outreach toolkit makes it easy for you to deliver outreach in schools. It's got templates, resources specific to the sector. And we would really recommend that companies use them. You can check it out at www.lovefoodlovescience.org. We really love to see the number of STEM ambassadors in the sector increase to really help secure the talent pipeline for food industries. Really can't recommend checking that outreach toolkit enough.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes so that people can access that. Okay, thank you all very much. We have a little audience today, so if you have questions, Niamh, you can come and take my seat, so if you want to introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Niamh Doherty. I work with Angel in Group Technical Services. I've got a question for the whole group. So a lot of what people see, the young audiences online about food, is negative, kind of short viral clips or articles that focus on all the bad press. Do you think that the industry should be using the same 10-second influencer-style content to highlight the good stuff and an insight into the different areas that are often overlooked? And if so, do you think that that would resonate with younger audiences and influence them more to look into a career in food?
Definitely yes.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the world is changing, the social media, the influencers, it's all part of what is now, isn't it? And that's how messages get out. And I think as a food industry, we're trying to do bits through LinkedIn and TikTok and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We definitely need to put the positives out there. I think it's definitely something we need to do more of. We're trying as a business, but I think as an industry wider.
Yeah, 100%. We need to, we've talked about this for quite a while now about how we deal with this. Like, I would always say that if you want to get a message through to a 10-year-old, send them a text message. It's as simple as that, because that's where they're looking. And unfortunately, that is the reality of it now. You know, it's that. And these messages, we need to be getting these messages through to kids as young as that, you know, so they can see the food, the industry. It sparks interest, it creates passion, it does all of those things. Short form video is the way to do that. We need to be less reluctant to lift the veil of our business and our industry and let people look inside it. It's incredibly secretive and very insular, and you only really know it if you've been in it. We need to be part of that pride piece, is to say, we're proud for you to come and have a look at what we do. We shouldn't hide anything for that. And I think the more people see, the more interest gets, like the more interest is gained.
Yeah, I think it's the most accessible kind of
100%.
Stuff for young audiences to see now, isn't it?
Especially now, people have short attention span. Yeah. So with like creating a short reel or TikTok, it will be viral.
Absolutely.
But also, it's good for older people as well.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm putting it out there. Oh, I've got a TikTok. But I think it goes
easier than sitting and reading a full article.
Yeah. And this is the thing, 100%. And this is the thing. It's about providing that option. You know, we've got, you know, we do short form video through LinkedIn, and we do various bits and pieces there. Do we follow that up with long form video on YouTube? Probably not. And we should maybe give people the opportunity. If you want to come and have a look at more, come and have a look. You know,
it's
this
all visual as well, isn't it?
Exactly. It's about opportunity, it's about options, it's about give someone the opportunity. If we can get it out there and see it, then we get it out there, you know, and show people. The more people see it, the more people will be interested in it, I know it. And not the bad stuff.
Yeah.
There's loads of good stuff.
Hi, I'm Lisa Bayliss. I'm the group audit manager. And my question is, on the back end of the governmental involvement last year and their launch of Make It Work in collaboration with IGD, their outreach to young people was approximately 7 million. And now we are saying this year we've got a time bomb shortage. So do you think that they've done enough? What do you think they could have done better? They have a full website, there's videos, there's collaboration with 55 industry participants, food manufacturers. Do you think that they could do anything differently? Has the follow-up been good enough?
Lots of questions in that one.
Yeah, they've got to just stop thinking that shouting once is enough. They just need to shout more. Keep it going. We can build a website. We can build a channel, or whoever the government, they can build a website, a channel, great slogan, loads of money. Let's put loads of marketing into it and let's launch it and do a huge launch event. And then 2 weeks later, and that's the problem. To pick up on Angel's point, you know, the attention span of anyone nowadays is shorter. It's definitely shorter in whatever we look at. If we launch something with just a one-off launch event, you can guarantee that no one is going to remember that 2 weeks later. They just won't. You've got to keep going and keep going and keep going until it starts to attach. And then still other people then start to expand on that. And then you build your self-generated kind of marketing push the same way. You can't just shout about these things once. That would be my thing.
Yeah, and I think that's what's happened.
Yeah, just put it out. A great initiative.
Yeah.
You know, we see it all the time, loads of initiatives coming out there and loads of great materials that can go out there and that can be used. But they launch the idea in the hope that someone will pick it up and grab it and run with it. But it just doesn't take one time to like getting engagement takes time mm-hmm. and a lot of time and a lot of effort. And if they're not willing to put that effort in, then it's just wasted time. That would be my answer anyway. Sorry.
No, that's a very good answer.
Right. So has everyone got TikTok?
Yeah.
It's a thing, right? No shame in it. I love TikTok. I think it's brilliant. So one thing I do see, and one of the things that didn't really come up in this conversation was about chefs, and I think it's an important one, right? There's a lack of chefs in the industry, but that means, okay, so if you look at TikTok now, you don't have to be a chef to be a food influencer, okay? For some reason, and I have no idea why, well, obviously, I know what is food in my algorithm when I look at TikTok, but because there always would be. But I get a lot of these guys making protein recipes, right? Oh, if you make this, if you put this in, put that in, put that in. And now there's a guy out there who I've just noticed who has come up on who is making the recipes that other people are making so you don't have to make them. But he's trying to get you to make them. And he's selling his personal training business. He's saying, oh, but you can make this. And his videos are great. He's very funny, you know, and he's got me. I'm kind
Does
of
engaged with
it.
Going off in the background and then he starts chucking stuff around the kitchen? Is it that one?
No, not at all. He's literally just like, so the video will go, add a cup of protein powder, and he'll go, one cup of protein powder, add some blueberries, there's some blueberries. And he's literally just doing exactly the same thing again. He's not doing anything new. And then he cooks it. What he does keep on saying is, and they say, oh, now put it in the air fryer. Because I'm going to keep saying, I haven't got an air fryer and I refuse to get an air fryer until I get this many subscribers. Knowing full well that if he keeps going, someone's going to send him an air fryer. Mm. He's playing a game, you know? And I think that's it. And I think you've got the same content being completed by multiple people. And that's why you don't have chefs, because people don't need to be a chef. Why do I need to go and work? I've worked as a chef before and the hours are so hard. It's such a difficult environment. And that was 20 odd years ago, so it was a long time ago. But and I think even Robin picked up on it as well. And that's why, because I don't have to do that. If I want to be a famous on the TV chef, I don't have to do that. I'll just set up a TikTok channel, make food, and hope I get some engagement from somewhere.
That's right.
Difficult, right?
I was just going to add, just on the audience's question, I guess, yeah, we're aware of Make Your Mark campaign by IGD, fully behind it. But as Steve was saying, campaigns like that, I think, need to be really regular because to get it in people's minds. I guess for me, you can't really understand how powerful the face-to-face communication is. Like, whilst those are big social media campaigns and people see social media, how powerful face-to-face can be. If I hadn't spoken to that guy from Samworth Brothers back when I was at school, I probably wouldn't have entered the food industry. Even though outreach can feel like you're talking to maybe one small class of people, is that really making a difference? But they're so much more likely to kind of use your advice and go and work in the industry if you go and speak to them face to face. So it worked for me, and I can't recommend doing that enough.
That concludes today then. Thank you very much. I think you've been a great panel, been very informed and very qualified to answer all the questions. So I hope this has given you something to chew on.
Yay!
And can I just apologise that I had to nip out, but I needed to do two things, cough and...